Just understand what you're asking for. But, you know, if all the unions come out and say, don't do anything, it's going to be a void. You can see where the votes are going to fall.
Really likes our bill.
Okay.
Because our
members don't pay attention to pension policy.
The Senate Judiciary Committee will come to order. So, members, today we're going to have a discussion on the different forfeiture proposals that have been introduced. The way that I like to proceed, and I think that we have notified the public about this, is that I'm going to have Mr. Backus walk us through two of the bills, and then Senator Latz is going to present his bill. In your packets, members, there is a chart that is a comparison of the three bills that are in the committee today. And the purpose is to, this is an area of the law that is really important, but the proposals have different aspects to them. So I thought what we would like to do, or how I would like to proceed today, is I'd like to have the language of the bills presented to the committee members so that we understand what's in the bills themselves. And then once the bills have been explained to us, then we will take testimony from the public. And I would appreciate it if members of the public could just maybe identify which bills you're speaking to, or which part of your comments goes to which bill, and we'll take note of that. That would be the most expeditious way for us to get through these three bills. And then what I'd like to do is today will be for us to discuss the bill, ask questions to understand these three bills, take testimony and inputs and suggestions from the public, and then we're going to lay this over so that we can have an opportunity for the authors as well as those who have an interest in this to continue to talk about these proposals that are out there. And at some point in the next couple, 2 to 3 weeks, we will come back with a committee proposal that will incorporate, hopefully, the different concepts that are represented here, and then incorporating some of the suggestions and comments from the public. And so, members, I would invite you to, as we move through the bill, to also use this as an opportunity to chat with the authors about the specific provisions that are of concerning to you, or if you have any thoughts or ideas on how we can put something, a committee bill together of sort that would be most helpful for you to talk to the authors. So why don't we start with Senate File 2579, and I'm going to have Mr. Backus explain 2579.
Madam Chair and members, and just to remind members, as always, there are detailed section-by-section summaries of all three bills in members' packets. And again, the chart is meant to be basically an issue-by-issue bill as opposed to overview as opposed to section-by-section, just to give you a sense of how the bills work together or don't work together. I won't concentrate on the chart at all, but if you have any questions, please ask, except for the first part of the chart, the first cell on Section 1 is kind of an introduction. The three bills, Senate File 2579, Senator Mott's first bill, that bill basically concentrates on controlled substance forfeitures, both administrative and judicial, but basically just the controlled substance forfeitures, with the exception that it goes beyond those in terms of reporting requirements. It attempts to have all forfeitures be reported to the state auditor, and it also goes beyond controlled substance forfeitures when it requests the legislative auditor to conduct a program evaluation regarding forfeitures. And that bill, and as well as the next bill, Senate File 2634, both work within existing forfeiture laws, so they just do page and line amendments as we usually do. Senator Latz's bill does do a comprehensive recod for forfeiture law, and then it repeals the existing laws. Senate File 2634 also, again, works within existing law, but it's a little broader in scope than Senate File 2579 in that It doesn't particularly concentrate on just controlled substance forfeitures, but it goes beyond that to other types of forfeitures. And then again, Senate File 2613, which is the LATS bill, is really the most comprehensive in terms of the three bills, in terms of its scope and the types of forfeiture laws that are amended there. With that, then, I'll go into Senate File 2579, unless anyone has any questions. So that bill, Senator Moore's bill there, the first five sections, sections 1 to 5, and then sections 12 and 13, basically what they do is they add cross-references in the game and fish, the wetlands, the DWI, the gambling, and the racketeering forfeiture laws. They add cross-references in those laws to the new beefed-up reporting requirements that's contained in section 10 of her bill. So those sections, in conjunction with Section 10, basically means that all forfeitures then are going to be reported to the state auditor. Currently, there's a gap where certain forfeitures like game and fish and DWI aren't reported or aren't required to be reported. Sections 6 and 14, then, what they do is they require the Minnesota County Attorneys Association and the Minnesota Post Board to develop model policies on controlled substance forfeitures. And each entity would do its own model policy applicable to either prosecutors or applicable to law enforcement. But the model policies would be to encourage the uniform application of these forfeiture laws across the state. And then once the model policies are prepared, the chief law enforcement officers in each state and local law enforcement agency and each county attorney in the 87 counties would adopt a local policy that would either be identical or substantially similar to the model policy. And then there's a reporting requirement to the legislature. Section 7 and then Section 9 amend, and under current law, there's an evidentiary presumption in favor of forfeiture for property that is subject to controlled substance administrative forfeiture. So if the administrative forfeiture is challenged and it is determined judicially, or if it's initially filed as a judicial forfeiture, there is this evidentiary presumption in favor of forfeiture that these sections would strike. Section 8 amends the controlled substance judicial forfeiture law. In that law, and also, and we'll get to that, I think it's Section 10, I'd have to look, basically has threshold amounts for certain types of forfeitures within those sections. So if you look on page 3, line 13 and line 16, for example, for conveyance device forfeitures or for real property forfeitures, there has to be a certain amount of controlled substances, a retail value of a certain amount involved. This bill quadruples that amount. In addition, in that Section 8, it provides that real property is subject to forfeiture under the judicial forfeiture law, is not subject to forfeiture if the forfeiture would create an undue hardship for members of the owner's immediate family. Section 9 amends the Controlled Substance Administrative Forfeiture Law, and it does a number of things. We already talked about the change in the presumption. It also quadruples the threshold amount that's applicable to administrative forfeitures of conveyance devices. It adds a new threshold amount for the administrative forfeiture of money, precious metals, and precious stones found in proximity to controlled substances. It would require that in order for those types of property to be administratively forfeited, there would have to be at least $100 retail value of the controlled substances that they're found in proximity to. It also puts a cap on the dollar amount of property that can be forfeited administratively, and it sets that cap at $7,500. Under current law, there's no cap to the amount of money that can be administratively forfeited in Minnesota. It also provides a 10 business day requirement for the time period in which a person known to have an ownership interest in property that's been seized has to be notified. Under current law, it just provides within a reasonable time. So this would essentially define reasonable time as 10 business days. It also, under the administrative forfeiture law, there's a very specific, and you could look at the language if you want, beginning on 5.20, a very specific language that has to be put in notices of forfeiture. and that notice has to be given in English, Hmong, and Spanish. This bill would include Somali on that list, and it would also strike the specific wording of the notice and would replace that with a requirement that the notice be worded in plain language that is likely to be easily understandable. It also provides for that the notice has to have a separate detachable form that a person can use to object to the forfeiture as opposed to doing a separate complaint, which is currently required. In that same vein, it attempts to make it easier for a person to object to an administrative forfeiture. Under current law, the person has to, it's more formal, the person has to do it in the form of a civil complaint. It has to be served properly, and there has to be the filing fee paid. Under this provision, the objection has to be written still, but it can be much more informal. And what would happen if a person objects is, under current law, the forfeiture then is basically automatically converted to a judicial forfeiture. This provision would basically end the forfeiture at that point, and if the prosecutor decides that the prosecutor wants to pursue a forfeiture, the prosecutor would have to initiate one under the judicial forfeiture law by a separate complaint. The next section is Section 10. We talked a little bit about it. It's the reporting requirement for forfeitures. First, it provides that every forfeiture in the state, regardless of the statutory authority, will have to be reported to the state auditor. It also beefs up the type of information that must be included in the reports. And then finally, it provides that in the case of forfeitures initiated by multi-jurisdictional law enforcement agencies, that those entities have to report the forfeitures that they've initiated on their own behalf, as opposed to perhaps the individual law enforcement agency doing it. Section 11 makes a similar change to the drive-by shooting administrative forfeiture law, and it would also allow for that more informal process of objecting that we talked about earlier for the controlled substance forfeitures. We talked about the reporting requirements, and we also talked about Section 14. That takes us to Section 15, and that requests the Legislative Audit Commission to conduct an evaluation on forfeitures in Minnesota, and then it provides what type of things should be in the audit if feasible. Before I go on to the next bill, does anyone have any questions?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Backus. Now we're looking at Senate File 2634.
Madam Chair and members, Senate File 2634 then, beginning with Section 1, Sections 1 through 4 amend what I called the general forfeiture law. We don't really have a general forfeiture law in Minnesota, but we do have a series of forfeiture laws that are codified in the criminal code beginning around Section 609.531. Those laws are applicable to controlled substance forfeitures, designated offense forfeitures, drive-by shooting forfeitures, contraband forfeitures, and residential rental property forfeitures. So these first four provisions deal broadly to those forfeitures. So Section 1 requires a law enforcement officer to provide a receipt when seizing property. Section 2 changes statutory language that is currently permissive in regards to the duty of a law enforcement agency to take steps necessary to secure the property and prevent waste. Under current law, they may do that. This provides that they shall use reasonable diligence to secure the property and prevent waste. Section 3 authorizes the county attorney, or authorizes a person who has an interest in forfeited property to file with the county attorney a petition for remission or mitigation of the forfeiture, and then authorizes the county attorney to do so if under certain circumstances if the county attorney chooses to. Section 4 requires the Department of Public Safety to develop ethical guidelines and training procedures to be used by law enforcement agencies and prosecuting attorneys in carrying out forfeitures. And it requires agencies to file an annual certificate of compliance with the department. Section 5 amends the Controlled Substance Judicial Forfeiture Law. And similar to Senator Moss' other bill, this addresses one of the threshold amounts for the forfeiture of conveyance devices that contain controlled substances. Senator Ma's bill, other bill, quadruples it. This doubles it, and that's on line 3.15 of the bill. Sections 6 and 7 amend These sections are applicable to the controlled substance forfeiture laws, judicial and administrative, and the designated offense forfeiture laws. And what they do in part is they require a county attorney to send notice of the intent to forfeit property within 90 days from which seizure occurs. The county attorney is authorized to petition a court for an additional time period for good cause shown. If the time period is not complied with, the property has to be returned. However, the agency retains the right to reinstitute forfeiture proceedings in the future. Section 7 amends the Controlled Substance Administrative Forfeiture Law, and it puts a cap of $75,000 on the amount of property or the value of property that can be forfeited administratively. And you can compare this to the previous bill where the cap was set at $75,000. And this also puts the same notice requirements we already talked about in the previous section. Section 8 amends the administrative controlled substance forfeiture law to provide that when a person converts a forfeiture from an converts an administrative forfeiture to a judicial one, that the judicial hearing would have to be held within 180 days following the filing of the demand by the complainant. And then Sections 9 to 11 amend the laws applicable to the disposition of forfeited property for the types of forfeiture I mentioned earlier, not all forfeiture, but just these. Section 9 prohibits law enforcement agencies from selling property to employees or officers of the agency or their family members. Section 10 provides that for an uncontested controlled substance administrative forfeiture, before the law enforcement agency can distribute the money or the proceeds, a county attorney would have to have reviewed and certified that the law enforcement agency provided a receipt in accordance with the law, gave proper notice in accordance with the law, and that probable cause for the forfeiture exists based on the law enforcement officer's statement. Section 11 amends the law again relating to disposition of forfeited property. It maintains the current statutory split for proceeds, which is 70% to law enforcement, 20% to prosecutors, and 10% to the general fund. But what it does is it requires the money for law enforcement or prosecutors essentially to go in like a trust fund that would be administered by the governmental agency that oversees the entity. For example, if it's a sheriff's department, it would be the county would oversee the fund. So I think it attempts to give a little more oversight to how the funds would be used, but the money still goes to the same entities it would otherwise go to. And Madam Chair, that's it for that bill. If people have questions on this one.
Any questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I wanted to ask about the receipt language. Is that not required today for the officer to leave a receipt, give a receipt?
Mr. Backus?
Madam Chair and Senator Scheid, to my knowledge, it's not. A law enforcement officer, I think what would happen, practically speaking, is for an administrative forfeiture at least, my understanding is the law enforcement officer would usually give the notice of the intent to receipt when they're seizing the property in that context. But this is an addition to that. So this would be a separate receipt for the property.
A little bit later, once we're done with going through the bills, if we have somebody who's going to come up to testify, if you have knowledge of the information to answer that question, will you please make sure that you speak to it? Because I think it'd be helpful to hear it from how it is in practice, how that's done, and whether this receipt provision is helpful. All right. Any other questions for Mr. Backus on these two bills? Very good. Thank you, Mr. Backus. Is Senator Latz here yet? Hi. Come on in.
Yes, thank you. Thank you.
Senator Latz, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I just want to make sure I got your anticipated procedure done. You'd like me to walk through the bill briefly, and then I have a colleague here with me from the bar who will be prepared to offer some thoughts on its impact. Or did you want to hold that?
I'd like to hold his, he'll be part of the testimony piece, which will be very shortly after your bill. So I'm sure we would definitely take your comments. You can just stay seated there. We're going to have you walk us through the bill and see if members have any questions for you on the mechanics of the bill. And then we'll start with your witness as the first in our list of witnesses to speak to these three bills. So,
thank you. Madam Chair, what I'd like to do, I know you've got the members, you have the summary from Mr. Backus of the proposed changes in this bill, right? Okay. What I'd like to do, I've got a slightly different summary that I have that kind of breaks it into some substantive areas that I think might be helpful in putting the bill into context rather than a specific walkthrough of the memo that you've got in front of you anyway. So if I might do that, Madam Chair. There are some major components to my proposal here. The two key parts of it are, one, it requires a conviction for the underlying forfeiture-related offense, a criminal conviction before a forfeiture can be undertaken. Current law provides for administrative civil forfeiture, which can occur independently of whether or not criminal charges are even brought, let alone result in a conviction for the offense that would give rise to the forfeiture. This bill would require that there be a criminal conviction of that designated offense of the property that's used in the commission of the offense. And the second main component of the bill is that it removes entirely the conflict of interest that law enforcement experiences when they decide to pursue a forfeiture. That is, law enforcement will have no direct financial interest in the proceeds resulting from the sale of the forfeited property. As has already been explained, and as you all are already aware, their proceeds are divided in a number of ways, including some money which goes directly to the agency that is initiating the forfeiture. So they have a direct financial interest in pursuing that forfeiture, and this bill would separate that out. So the money then would go to the general fund of the state and would ultimately be allocated according to our normal process. So let me just kind of break this down here. The burden of proof in this bill would require that the state proves in a forfeiture action, would prove by clear and convincing evidence, so a mid-range burden of proof higher than a preponderance of the evidence, but not the standard used for a criminal conviction, by clear and convincing evidence that the owner of the property was convicted of the designated offense and that the property was either an instrumentality of the crime or represents the proceeds of that crime. Okay, so it has to have been used to commit the crime or have to have been basically the financial benefits achieved from committing a crime, such as the money obtained by selling drugs. Second piece here is that the property could be released prior to final determination, and that can occur in three ways. So an owner of the property can obtain release of the property that's been seized and potentially subject to forfeiture either by posting a bond to obtain possession of that or by submitting title of, say, for example, the vehicle in return for possession. So you can't sell the vehicle without the title, so in that sense the property is protected. Or by requesting and being successful at a probable cause hearing, a hearing that demands that probable cause be established for the forfeiture to move forward, and if a judge were to conclude that there was no probable cause, then the property would have to be released to the owner. The forfeiture hearings would not be subject to the rules of civil procedure, so it would be a more streamlined proceeding than the overall than the current civil forfeiture proceedings. A notice would have to be given, and this for given all the testimony that we've heard over the interim, how important notice is. This notice would have to be in plain language. It would have to accompany a complaint against the property. There would have to be a form called a return of notice form that can serve as an answer to the complaint. So basically, when they get the notice, they get the form that they can respond with as well. And the form would need to be filed with the server of the notice or with district court. So, I'm sure I'll be corrected if I'm misstating anything of the detail in the bill, but presumably you could fill out the notice or the form when you receive it and hand it back to the party that's serving you, and that would be sufficient. Am I understanding that?
That was my reading.
Yeah. So it really makes it easy for the owner to challenge the forfeiture. Currently, there are a lot of barriers in the law to it, barriers which become, as a practical matter, insurmountable. One of those other barriers, by the way, that would be removed here is that if the owner of the property would not have to file or pay a filing fee in order to challenge the forfeiture. Currently, a filing fee is about $320 to challenge a forfeiture. Well, if the property is not worth much more than that, you know, it's hardly worth even fighting over if you're the owner of it from a financial standpoint. There is an innocent owner defense, which is included in here. And this has been most recently in the news in connection with the Edina mother or woman whose property was sought to be forfeited. And a judge ruled that it was not properly forfeited. It was, I think, driven by a child, if I remember correctly. But then since that time, the state Supreme Court has come out with a ruling that contradicts that particular outcome, which strictly construed current law. And so this would say if you can establish that you're the innocent owner, you get your property back. And it defines this very carefully. Property owned by a person not convicted of the designated offense is not subject to forfeiture unless it was intended to defeat the forfeiture or there was consent to the crime. So if the owner is somehow actually involved in the commission of the offense, then they couldn't get around that by using the statute. But if you are truly an innocent owner, not involved in the commission of the offense, there's no imputed knowledge, which is currently used to forfeit the property.
Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Lutz, I mean, we're one of the areas where that kind of raises a concern for me would be in a situation where you've got, let's just say, a habitual drunk driver, or perhaps a child where the parent owns the vehicle, and you're wanting to, I think, instituted the forfeiture law in those situations in the first place to try to prevent people from using their cars while they're driving while drunk, and from car owners to take some responsibility for making sure that someone who's been drinking isn't using their vehicle. And so for someone with a long record in that regard, they're unlikely to be able to get insurance and title a vehicle. But if they've got someone living with them or another family member or someone, they can avoid that by just titling the vehicle in that name and driving the car. So the person under your definition wouldn't be intending to have that person go out and commit a crime. But at the same time, aren't we removing the incentive for that person to be responsible about how their car would be used?
That was my question.
Madam Chair.
Senator Latz.
Senator Olson, it's a balancing act that's here because you have circumstances where you might have a spouse that would, with a wink and a nod, allow an unlicensed husband, for example, who's got multiple DWIs and no license to use the vehicle, and if it gets forfeited, well, then they'd have this loophole, you might say. On the other hand, you've got innocent wives that take every step they can think of to, you know, protect the car keys and to avoid, their ne'er-do-well DWI-prone husband from driving, but they need to have the vehicle in the family because she needs to be able to get to work to support the family. And when she's asleep, the husband decides to find the keys, take them, and go out and drive and get another DWI, and then you got a vehicle subject to forfeiture. Well, is that fair, too, when the innocent wife did everything that she could, short of not having a vehicle to protect against it? It's a balancing act, and this attempts to draw the line in favor of at least protecting the innocent owner and the family that depends on having the vehicle.
Senator Olson and then Senator Scheid. Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I would just say I like most of your bill, but I don't like that part of it because as compared to the two, as much as I sympathize for, say, a wife in that kind of circumstance, I sympathize more for the driver out on the road that's being totally innocent and hit by a drunk driver. And so, you know, I guess to me that loophole is too wide, and I would be concerned about that. But as far as the rest of your bill, I really like the concept of where you're moving the burden of proof and the requirement for a conviction and so forth.
Senator Scheid.
Excuse me, Madam Chair. I don't want to just repeat what Senator Olson said, but I circled that, excuse me, that the phrase or the person consented, because I think that I'm concerned about that in-between case where against your better judgment you let somebody use your car or do, you know, take an action when you thought you had a lot of reason to think that they might be out drinking or doing something wrong because they'd done it before. That's not exactly consenting to the underlying criminal act or even the conduct. I think you need something in the middle there. You've drawn a line, but it's completely letting some people off the hook. And I think there's a substantial number of people that make bad decisions for a family member or friend.
Good input. Senator Latz, please proceed.
Thank you. The bill imposes upon law enforcement an affirmative duty to return property that is not subject to forfeiture, and also imposes upon them a duty of care with regard to the seized property to store it in such a way as to protect its value and avoid its theft and that kind of thing. It provides that the disposition of the property must be done in a commercially reasonable manner and specifically prohibits sale of the property to officers of the seizing agency, again, avoiding that potential conflict of interest there. And here we get to the point of further implementing that avoidance of conflict of interest. The disposition of the proceeds, after covering the costs of the forfeiture, the bill provides for the proceeds to go to the general fund to be appropriated for public safety. And then it's within the purview of the legislature where and how within the public safety realm to appropriate that money. It, like the other bills that you have before you, it broadens the reporting requirements so that all forfeitures are reported, including the amount, the underlying crime, any liens on the property, whether or not the forfeiture was contested, any firearms that were involved, and the final method of disposition. And then the bill also provides for coordination with federal law. So those are the main elements.
Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, could Senator Latz perhaps expand on at the bottom of page 8, subdivision 15, about the real property and what is that getting at? I don't know. Maybe you said something about it, but I missed it. It's about the Department of Corrections Fugitive Apprehension Unit.
Mr. Backus, can you speak to that?
Madam Chair and Senator Scheid, since this bill is essentially a recodification, there's a lot in this bill that are going to be current law.
Okay.
And basically that's scattered throughout the statutes and current law. When the Department of Corrections Fugitive Apprehension Unit was named as an appropriate agency for forfeiture years ago, their authority was limited.
Thank you. Thank you.
Any other questions for Senator Latz? Senator Orman.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Latz. A lot of work went into this bill, I can see, and a lot of review. I'm concerned about where it's heading, honestly, because I think the whole underlying concept of forfeiture seizure was that we would help fund crime-fighting efforts through our law enforcement. And it was passed originally in the 1980s when there wasn't a lot of money to fund or to add to funding for law enforcement, and yet we were having all these problems with drugs. And I think that the initial impetus for this was a very good one. Maybe some changes need to be made, and I believe that there probably are some good changes that we can make here, but I think this goes very far. And one of the questions I have for you, Senator Latz, is you've said that in your bill you would make sure that law enforcement does not benefit from seizures. I'm not sure that they do, but I don't want to get into the semantics of that. I'm wondering, where do the proceeds go in your bill? I'm not following. Where does the money go if it's not going to law enforcement or prosecutors, attorney generals? Where does it go?
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, I think it's incontrovertible that law enforcement currently benefits financially from forfeitures. The statute provides for the distribution of forfeiture proceeds to law enforcement agencies in some percentage of the amount that's realized from the sale of the property. So, and we heard hours of testimony over the interim about how the task force, the gang strike force, and other task forces, drug task forces, rely upon to some amount or another the proceeds from forfeitures to fund their operations. And we even had the dollar figures in front of us. So there's no question that law enforcement gains financially in terms of their operations from the forfeiture proceeds. And in fact, a lot of the testimony we received on the gang strike force was that there was such pressure from the top that they needed to have the funds to operate, that they weren't adequately funded from the other funding streams, that it was important to maintain the forfeiture process and to gather proceeds. And in some cases, the allegations are to simply directly capture and not even report cash in connection with their law enforcement activities. So this bill attempts to separate out that incentive completely. There were some members of the gang strike force that are alleged to have essentially stolen stuff. I'm not suggesting that activity is widespread, but certainly the incentives to pursue civil forfeitures with the cash benefits that come into the agency's budgets are real and, in fact, relied upon to fund law enforcement activities to one degree or another. And this bill would separate out that financial incentive. It would remit the proceeds to the state general fund with a designation that it be appropriated from the general fund for public safety purposes. Now, precisely how that gets allocated, whether it goes directly back to the Department of Public Safety for distribution to drug task forces, or whether it goes into some other public safety-related purpose, would be subject to the appropriation process of the legislature. But it would at least have that that general designation on it that it should go to public safety purposes.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I can't claim to know what the discussion was at the legislature when these laws were imposed in the 80s, because I haven't researched the legislative history, but I do remember when I was in law school from 80 to 83, a criminal law professor I had then was writing for the law review about the concept of using vehicle forfeiture in relation to DUIs. And at that time, it was a pretty novel idea nationally, and I did some research for him on that topic, and I don't recall that funding law enforcement had anything to do with the rationale being put forth by the people who were working on this as a policy issue. I think it had to do with deterrence, and I think it had to do with getting the means of causing harm to others out of the hands of the person who was misusing that property. And so it may have become to be seen as a method to help fund law enforcement as time's gone by, but I'd be surprised if that was why we passed, you know, why we put this in place in the first place. And I guess I think we ought to, if that's in fact true, try to stay true to the underlying policy for this and prevent those conflicts of interest, and also make sure that we are being respectful of constitutional principles, which I think your bill, that's why I think you have a good bill here. But I don't like the part that might allow that loophole, because I think there is a deterrence value. One of the biggest
areas this comes up in my neck of the woods in the state is in the area of hunting regulations, hunting and fishing regulations. And when somebody knows that they might lose their gun over even a very technical violation, people really want to pay attention to what those laws are to make sure that they don't put themselves in that position because they really value their gun or their boat or their pickup, you know. And so there's a, for people who want to follow the law, it's just, it's an extra incentivizer. But I don't think that we want to require people to have to come and prove after the fact that, you know, the kinds of things that we've, I think we've gone too far with what we're allowing right now, and your bill puts it back in its proper place, this concept of forfeiture.
Senator Ortman, oh, Senator Latz, did you want to respond to that?
If I might, Madam Chair, Senator Olson, you've identified really kind of two issues there. One is the question of what do you do with the proceeds? And where the proceeds go is of no particular concern for the owner whose property is being forfeited. If there is a deterrent value, the fact of forfeiture will have its deterrent value. So whether the proceeds end up in the law enforcement agency or in the state general fund, they are less concerned about, except to the extent that despite what might have been the original purpose or intent or policy goal of forfeiture, the financial incentives have become a part of the system, whether individual agencies or law enforcement officers are able to effectively separate out the purposes in their own minds, their intents in their own minds, from the financial outcomes of the forfeiture is sort of like asking a jury to disregard that comment that was just made on the witness stand. It's still in their mind, and you have to ask them to kind of separate it out and not consider it in the analysis that they're going to have to go through. I have been told, I haven't done the research myself, however, that in the area of DWIs, that there is not much, if any, statistical evidence to support the proposition that vehicle forfeiture deters DWI activity. Now, I will say again, I haven't done the research myself. I would encourage maybe us to get some of that information. But if the purpose is deterrence, I think we ought to look at some evidence to find out if, in fact, that is what is happening.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Latz, I had hoped not to get into a discussion about the semantics of benefits, but I think we're there because of your recent comments. I don't think that law enforcement benefits as you're describing it. It's almost like you think that there's some incentive created for law enforcement to go find assets, and I don't believe that. Now, I know that the commander of the MGSF may have said that in testimony. I didn't believe it when he said it. I still don't believe it, because the state was fully funding the operating budget of the MGSF. We found that he was not a very credible testifier for many reasons. And I don't think that you can use that broad a brush on law enforcement to think that they are out there trying to find assets to fund operations when they are not allowed to do that. And the federal guidelines say they may not supplement operational budgets with seized assets. And then I'd like to make one other point about that. When they go out and are working and end up seizing assets, they're often connected with guns and drugs. They're taking the tools of the crime, if you will. There might be money there. There might be a vehicle or a computer, but they're taking the tools of the crime to stop what's happening and put somebody out of the business of conducting crime. That's the whole point. And so I don't think they're out looking for money to fund operations. I know they're not. I don't think that they're trying to find financial incentives for themselves. I think they're trying to fight crime. And they're trying to keep people from succeeding in crime. And if they have to walk away from a crime scene and leave the assets, then they may have to fight that crime again or those criminals again. And I think that's the purpose here, is to help them fight crime. And I think our communities want them to. I think there should be reasonable regulations of what they do. I absolutely agree we should provide as much notice. We should provide receipts, a better process for the return of property or assets if they have not been properly seized. But I think this goes too far to try and punish law enforcement for what may have gone wrong with the MGSF. And your example of property being stolen by officers at the MGSF, I think that opens up a whole different world that I don't think even the law enforcement community in Minnesota was I think everyone was surprised at what was happening there. And so I don't think that you should use that broad brush here either as an excuse for what I think is trying to punish law enforcement for having done their job and done it well.
Senator Latz.
If I just may respond briefly, Madam Chair, nothing in this bill would change the ability of law enforcement to forfeit property used in the commission of a crime. Not one thing in this bill would punish law enforcement for taking those steps. If the defense of law enforcement is they need to be able to keep 20% or 30% of the proceeds because their budgets have become dependent upon it, that's a different discussion, and let's have that on the table. But this bill is not an attempt to tar and feather law enforcement or to tarnish them with a broad brush, but we did have specific examples of testimony in which there were concerns about conduct. And we saw the numbers in which at least budgets have become partially dependent upon, some part of law enforcement budgets have become partially dependent upon forfeiture proceeds. Now, if there is no incentive in there for them to go after forfeitures, if the full purpose is to take the instrumentalities of the crime, then this bill will have absolutely no impact on that goal, and I fully support that goal.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm just to make sure that there's an accurate record of how this would work, my understanding is law enforcement would not have to go back and get that property a second time. Nothing's preventing them from taking it at the time and holding it as evidence of the crime. But then if they were not convicted of that crime, then I'm understanding that the property then would have to be returned unless they were to meet the standard of clear and convincing evidence. Is kind of in a nutshell, that's what I'm understanding would happen. And I also think that we should be sure that we once again emphasize that it's no one's intent here to take what happened with the Metro Gang Strike Force and in any way imply that kind of behavior was happening anywhere else outside of the Metro Gang Strike Force. We certainly actually have a lot of evidence that would show that's not the case. However, just the fact that it happened anywhere or appears to have happened or is alleged to have happened anywhere demonstrates what can happen when you have a conflict of interest type of situation, and I think that's one of the things we're trying to avoid. But to me, the even more important principle is just that, you know, that there's after something like that happens, that there's an appearance to the public of our system being designed in such a way as to never cause anyone to doubt in the future whether there's any mixed reason why law enforcement might be taking some action, and that it's really important that the public be able to have that confidence.
Well, Senator Olson, I think that the very, very thorough conversations we had this summer has given the public an opportunity to see the great work that our law enforcement are doing. You know, we spent a full day given an opportunity for some of our best and brightest to come into the committee to share with us their best practices out on the road. And, you know, some of the things that they talked about in those during that committee hearing were really not that far off from some of the proposals that are on the table today. And so I think that because we made the time to have a very thorough discussion in the interim, I hope that we have more than adequately offer up to the public that the Metro Gang Strike Force is an unfortunate incident on its own. That being said, any of the subsequent policies or proposals that we'll be considering is, as policymakers, we seize an opportunity to rethink or to to look at what's before us, because what we want is to be able to make sure that the public policies that we consider are the best that there is. And so this is, I think, a really good opportunity for us to revisit, I mean, triggered by that incident. But I think, and I hope, and I know, that the thorough work that we did this summer has really given the public an opportunity to see and to understand and to be able to parse out what is the unique situation and how our law enforcement practitioners out there are really doing at the front line. And so I'm fairly confident that this hearing is not going to take us backwards in that direction. Any other questions for Senator Latz before we bring up our testifiers? Very good. Senator Latz, I understand that you have a family commitment. We thank you for making the time to be here to present the bill. I think that if you're comfortable, you should go and be with your family, and we'll take testimony and all the information will be on the record. And so I'm sure the advocates who are here on your bill would be more than glad to share with you the inputs that members want to give you further on your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that. And I do have a little bit of time before I have to leave, so I'll stick around, but I appreciate that. And if I might just add one other thought as I'm reviewing in response to some of the questions raised about the innocent owner question, I've taken a look at the actual language in the bill, which is on line 8.13 and to 8.19. And I think there might be some room to draw the lines perhaps a little more clearly or to find a way to accommodate some of the concerns that are there. It's the broad imputation of guilt or knowledge that is so objectionable in my mind to the current law. And where precisely, what language you use to draw the line more fairly, at least as I would interpret it, is certainly something that can be worked on.
Madam Chair?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Lemmer.
Thank you. Senator Latz, before you leave, I can't help but think about the administrative law or administrative fines that we allowed local police departments to impose, let's say, after traffic violations. Some of us thought that the money should go to a more general fund here at the state, and that the money would be distributed back again to communities according to need, not according to volume of speeding tickets that they might write. And some of us thought that that, too, might have been incentivizing the writing of traffic violations in order to accumulate funds for a different but local public purpose. And I'm wondering, in this discussion about the incentivizing of raising funds for a police department through forfeiture, do you have any idea to extend that concept into the administrative fines area of law?
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, from each according to ability to each according to need. Madam Chair, I don't have any specific response to Senator Limmer's question, but it's an interesting one to ponder.
Well, Madam Chair, the reason I bring it up is that's kind of the discussion that Senator Foley and I were united on in bringing up his bill, but it was not passed on the Senate floor last year. And so it does bring up a little comparison to at least be a comparison on how we deal with this issue. And I know that cities continually come to us saying that their local government aids are being cut or there's not enough funds. And I think this probably was a way to try to answer some of that cash flow. And so now if we don't allow it, then we have a new or a renewed political problem to solve, and that's budgets. So it's kind of funny how we pull a string on one end and it gets short on the other. And so I'm just trying to put things, one step will follow the other, and I'm trying to get there first before we make the decision.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Limmer, you know, I think you make a very fair point. And I guess my response to that would be that if we find any examples that would be equivalent to what happened with the Metro Gang Strike Force, where even one community is engaging in that kind of behavior, even though all the other communities are not, then we will probably want to look seriously at whether that was a good decision, just like we're looking at this. I would think, because I think you're making a very valid point.
Senator Latz, I believe Mr. Bass would like to offer up his testimony, and then we'll bring up the other testifiers. Mr. Bass, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Howard Bass. I am an attorney. I practice criminal defense and have for 25 years. I'm a former president of the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. Currently, I am an ACLU of Minnesota board member and volunteer attorney, and I'm here to testify on behalf of the ACLU of Minnesota.
Mr. Bass,
yes.
Those microphones don't amplify as much as they should, so I'm going to ask you to pull it really close, and then you may have to use an outdoor voice, if you would.
I can do that.
Thank you.
And I'm here on behalf of the ACLU of Minnesota to testify in support of Senator Latch's bill, Senate File 2613. I want to start first with first principles. In 1776, Thomas Jefferson penned our Declaration of Independence. And in that document, he wrote, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed." He used the trilogy of those three unalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Jefferson was inspired by a 17th century English philosopher named John Locke, who in his second treatise concerning civil government, published in 1689, wrote that there are certain natural rights that all human beings are born with. And those three rights include life, liberty, and property. Property, Jefferson termed as the pursuit of happiness. And while money may not be able to buy us love, it can certainly buy us happiness. I've never seen an unhappy lottery winner. When our Constitution was ratified and the Bill of Rights adopted, the Fifth Amendment prohibited the federal government from depriving citizens of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. After the Civil War, when the 14th Amendment was ratified, it prohibited state governments from depriving citizens of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. When our state constitution was ratified, Article 1, Section 7 prohibited the deprivation of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Certainly, ownership of property is a core American and Minnesotan civil liberty. It is essential to both our democratic political system and our capitalistic economic system. Civil asset forfeiture reform is necessary to protect our natural and inalienable property rights. I ask this committee, why is it that under current Minnesota law, the right to property is valued less than the rights to life and to liberty? Fortunately, we do not have, and hopefully never will have, capital punishment in this state, but were we to have it, the deprivation of life would require a criminal conviction. The deprivation of liberty requires a criminal conviction. The deprivation of property should likewise require a criminal conviction. Our current civil asset forfeiture laws place far too much authority in the hands of the police. Most of the assets that are seized and subject to forfeiture are seized without warrants, without judicial oversight. Warrantless seizures are presumptively unreasonable. for that very reason, that no judge, no magistrate, has reviewed the seizure before it occurred and authorized it. Administrative forfeiture occurs without judicial oversight, both at the time of the seizure and at the time of the forfeiture, unless the individual, the property owner, demands judicial determination of forfeiture and converts the administrative process into a judicial one. There is, as has been discussed, a great potential for abuse in a system like this. There is a financial motivation, a direct financial interest in administrative forfeiture by the people seizing the property, a conflict of interest. Moreover, the overwhelming number of forfeitures proceed administratively, thereby resulting in deprivation of property without due process, without any challenge, without any review, any oversight by the judicial branch. The burden should be placed on the government to commence judicial forfeiture following a conviction for a designated offense. It should not be on the property owner, as it is under current law, to commence that review prior to a conviction for a designated offense. Previously, this summer, I testified about a constitutional dilemma that can arise under our current administrative forfeiture framework, because under the current law, sometimes people are forced to choose between their inalienable and natural rights of liberty or property. The prototypical robber puts a gun in your face and says, your money or your life. That's a dilemma. You have to make a choice. Under current civil asset forfeiture law, police and prosecutors can say your property or your liberty. Civil forfeiture proceedings can be commenced before criminal charges are filed or while a criminal prosecution is pending. While an individual has a privilege against self-incrimination, the right to remain silent, guaranteed by the 5th and 14th Amendments to the United States Constitution, Article 1, Section 7 of the Minnesota Constitution. That creates a dilemma when litigating civil forfeitures, once you've transformed the administrative forfeiture into a judicial forfeiture by demanding judicial determination of forfeiture, while a criminal investigation or prosecution is pending. If in the civil proceeding you invoke your privilege against self-incrimination, an adverse inference arises, meaning that the court can take your exercise of your right to remain silent as an answer that would have been adverse to your interests. Delaying initiation of civil forfeiture proceedings until after a conviction for a designated offense avoids that constitutional dilemma. Now, I want to address Senators Olson and Scheid's concerns about the innocent owner provision in Senator Latz's bill. I believe it's subdivision 13B. The legislature can impose whatever penalty it wants on the drunk driver. It can increase penalties on drunk driving. It can incarcerate the drunk driver. And it's the drunk driver who's committing the crime that should be punished. Yet the innocent owner should not lose her asset because her husband drives drunk. Senator Latz commented that there may be some middle ground that can be found. As I look at subdivision 13B, it requires, in order for forfeiture, clear and convincing evidence that the property owner consented to the underlying criminal act or conduct. The middle ground that immediately leaps out at me is that the property owner either knew or should have known of the commission of the designated offense or conduct. If that can be proved by clear and convincing evidence, that may close the loophole that's identified and may protect the public against the vehicle being used in the future, while at the same time striking a balance and protecting a truly innocent owner from the wrongful deprivation of her property because of her husband's offense. Finally, on behalf of all Minnesotans, the ACLU of Minnesota urges you to reform our civil asset forfeiture laws and to restore our inalienable and natural right to property to its exalted place alongside our rights to life and liberty. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions, Mr. Bass? Senator Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Bass, and I apologize if you told us this last summer. I don't recall. But has anyone ever tested through the courts our current administrative forfeiture laws in terms of their constitutionality?
Mr. Bass?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, if they have, I can't tell you one way or the other. I'm not aware of any decision by the Minnesota appellate courts upholding their constitutionality. I can tell you I'm familiar with constitutional standards and challenges that have been brought federally. I can tell you in all candor that civil asset forfeiture procedures have been upheld against constitutional challenges. It's more of a matter of policy than of constitutional law that we urge you to protect the right to property to the same extent that the right to liberty and the right to life are currently protected under law.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, thank you. I appreciate that, and I agree with you in terms of the policy and in being consistent with the underlying intent of the Constitution. But considering how far our forfeiture law goes in terms of changing the burden of proof and all of that, I just wondered if either in this state or elsewhere those specific parameters have ever been challenged and tested and weighed one way or the other by the courts in terms of their constitutionality. And
any other questions for Mr. Bass? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'd like to call up to the table two witnesses, Mr. Charles Glassrud and Ms. Peggy Horsch. Ms. Glassrud, are you going to go first?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I will.
Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you. I am Charles Glassrud. I am the Stevens County attorney. Stevens County is way out west where Morris is. We got about 10,000 people in it. And through some fluke, I became the president of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. And so that's also what brings me here today.
How many minutes is your travel, Mr. Glassrud?
At legal highway speeds?
Yes, of course. Always.
Would be 3 hours.
Well, thank you so much for being here.
Well, it's my pleasure and an honor. Thank you. I would like to discuss a few basic principles and some suggestions, and then Peggy Horsch, who's with me here from Dakota County, will talk a little more specifically about some of the issues. In terms of basic principles, crime ought not to be profitable. And I think that's what underlies the concept of the forfeiture laws that, as we've acknowledged, have been on the books for some 25 years here in Minnesota. It's a common sense idea. And as I look at the forfeiture law that is currently in effect in Chapter 609.531, there are, in fact, and there was some discussion about this earlier, there were, in fact, five remedial purposes set forth in the statute. I cannot tell you whether those have been added to over time. I suspect they were there in the beginning, but because I don't know who goes in and amends a statute to add remedial purposes. But at any rate, this is what it says now. Number one, to enforce the law. Number two, to deter crime. Number three, to reduce the economic incentive to engage in a criminal enterprise. Number four, to increase the pecuniary loss resulting from the detection of criminal activity. And five, to forfeit property unlawfully used or acquired and divert the property to law enforcement purposes. So it's right there in the statute as it exists that it's more than merely a crime deterrence, that it actually has a positive benefit to those law enforcement agencies and prosecutors. Now, we also feel it's important that resolution of forfeiture cases be kept independent of resolution of criminal cases. And it's important, I think, to remember that we are talking about forfeiture which exists in a civil realm, and whether we discuss eliminating the civil rules, we're not quite sure what that means, but it's still a civil process with a different standard of proof versus the criminal process, and they need to stay separate. One of the reasons that they should stay separate is that what we find in practice is that there would be a tendency of defense attorneys to say, hey, if I give you the car, can we get the charges dismissed, for example, which we as prosecutors find to be a true conflict of interest and a problem for us. So we like to try to keep these concepts separate and not conflate them. If we were to say that you have to have a criminal conviction before you can have a forfeiture, then I would submit that there would be additional incentive for the prosecutor to perhaps want to seek a criminal conviction rather than do something that might be more just for the individual person, because as we know, criminal convictions bring with them all kinds of other collateral consequences. So we feel it's a good idea to keep these concepts separate and not have it dependent on a criminal conviction. In fact, some cases get resolved with stays of adjudication, with continuances for dismissal. Sometimes the defendant decides to turn state's evidence or become a snitch. Sometimes there's no way to prove who owned the illegal property that was sitting on the table around three people, all of whom say it wasn't mine. But it's still something that should be forfeitable. And all of those are examples where there wouldn't be a criminal conviction, but there's still strong policy in favor of doing a forfeiture. Now, we feel that obviously giving due and proper notice to people that they can understand in appropriate languages is important, should be done. They should and have been and do receive their due process rights. The current law does that. The current law, to our view, works. And my question would be, why do we want to change it? Madam Chair, I think the way you put it was that the gang strike force issue has perhaps brought to the fore the question of our forfeiture laws and invited us to take another look at them. And I think that's what has happened. But from the perspective of the prosecution and the vast majority of law enforcement officers that have been working out there enforcing the law for all of us all these years, it's confusing, because if you follow the existing forfeiture law, you don't have a problem. What allegedly happened in the gang strike force, and there's litigation on this, there may be prosecutions on this, I don't know all of the facts, but I know what I read, and what's alleged to have happened there would be what I would call theft, not forfeitures. So it is somewhat ironic to us that we would be taking a look at the forfeiture laws because of something that happened completely outside of anyone's notion of the proper application of the forfeiture laws. Now, since it is one of the provisions that the legislature talked about as being a purpose for the forfeiture law, it is a source of income that can be used to supplement law enforcement and prosecution budgets. That would go away largely, I think, particularly under one of the proposals, the LATS ACLU proposal. And certainly in terms of looking at these three bills, we see a great difference. That one, to me, frankly, would be a nightmare, and it would probably not result in a lot of forfeiture activity. There are a lot of policy reasons why we should be doing forfeitures. I suspect the impetus for passing that bill would be to eliminate or limit forfeitures, and that might be the result. Senate File 2634 is one that we find quite palatable, and most of the changes in there are not particularly objectionable at all. Not selling property to related persons, this would be something that probably most people had already figured out, but obviously not everybody. So how could we argue with putting that in there? That feels and seems inappropriate. Should there be some sort of trust accounting or proper accounting practices for proceeds? Absolutely. However, I would caution from the standpoint of county attorneys that if the county board, as is proposed, now holds the purse strings to that, we have the ironic situation of going to our county board and saying, this isn't your money, folks, and it isn't part of our budget. It's to supplement our budget, but I have to ask you to let it go even though it isn't yours. I think there could be better ways to ensure that there is open and proper accountability without having to run it through a procedure like that. Somali language in the notices, I think that's an excellent idea. The only thing we would suggest is that when there is a notice, we would like to have it on one sheet so the officer isn't saying, wait, can I find my Somali notice or do I have my Spanish notice? We would like to see them all on one sheet. And speaking of the notice, we also would have a concern about any bill that would no longer specify what the advisory should be to the recipient. If the legislature were to tell us we want it in plain language and we're not going to tell you exactly what it should say, then I think that's going to open the doors to a lot of different forms of language out there, and surely court tests of various iterations of that language, and I think that's unnecessary. So we would be happy to assist in the development of some language if it is felt that there needs to be some different language.
Mr. Glassroot, how about we identify the County Attorneys Association as the entity to develop the model language that then shall be used among all the entities operating out there?
Well, Madam Chair, we very much appreciate the faith that you put in us. I will note that no money is appropriated to us from the legislature, and so I think this might be the first time that we're required by law to do any particular thing. We're always willing to help. I think we share everyone's goal here of promoting the enforcement of our laws and the protection of public safety. If we have specific duties, a little appropriation going along with that would also be appreciated by us. But I think it would be a good idea for there to be some language in the statute rather than leaving open generally the concept of plain language and someone has to come up with it.
Senator Betzel.
On that point, the County Attorneys Association, I believe, is a private organization. I can't think of very many instances where the legislature has directed a private organization to do something. We can do that to governmental organizations. I don't know how far we can do it with private entities.
Point well taken, Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, if I may, that's an interesting point because at one time the County Attorney's Council was a creature of statute, and it's still in statute. We are called the County Attorneys Association. At one time we did have appropriations to us, and some years ago that was shifted over to the Attorney General's office, who receives at the present time $65,000 that is to be passed through to us for training purposes, and we're currently experiencing some difficulty getting that money. But it's not a simple question of whether we are or not, but I think technically Senator Betzold is correct. We are not, as County Attorneys Association, a state agency.
Senator Betzold, I think that I believe in 1995, the County Attorneys Association, in conjunction with the Attorney General's Office and the BCA, were named in a Chapter 388.25 to conduct trainings about sex offender sentencing. And I believe that may be where the money came with. And so when I was thinking about that, I was thinking about this precedent. But that's neither here nor there. I mean, what I heard is that you're willing to engage in that conversation, and that's the value. So
absolutely.
Please proceed.
We are. Thank you. You know, just to conclude my portion of this, I think the legislature wants to see greater coordination in this area and greater oversight in this area, and those are appropriate goals. The legislature, I take it, wants to see better training of law enforcement in how this procedure is administered, and we absolutely join in that goal. And in fact, training is always and has been a mission of the County Attorney's Association. So, yes, Madam Chair, we would be interested in pursuing options as far as helping out in that regard. Now I'd like to hand it over, if I may, to my associate here.
Ms. Horsch, welcome to committee. Please restate your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senators. My name is Peggy Horsch, and I am an assistant county attorney for Dakota County. And for the record, Madam Chair, I came 20 minutes. It took me 20 minutes to get here this morning from or this afternoon from Hastings, so following all the legal speed limits. Thank you for the opportunity to address you this afternoon. My areas of practice include the forfeiture area, and I've been doing this for a number of years. So I think my role here today is perhaps to give you some of the viewpoint of us in the trenches and the practical aspects of what I'm doing every day in the forfeiture area and how those may be impacted by the proposed legislation. First, I'd like to start by encouraging this committee to keep the option of a conciliation court available to claimants of seized property. In some of the proposed bills, the conciliation court option is removed. I say this because I believe this forum is beneficial to all parties in the forfeiture process, particularly pro se claimants. In Dakota County, a vast majority of our administrative controlled substance seizures is property that's valued $7,500 and less, so it would qualify for conciliation court. The current administrative forfeiture statute, 609.5314, allows the option of a claimant to file in conciliation court to seek return of his or her property if it's valued under that $7,500 limit. This is a quick, inexpensive, and fast way for claimants to get their cases heard. It's a way for people who aren't familiar with a courtroom, aren't familiar with what litigation is, to go in and present their case to a judge and then get a decision rendered. In my practical experience, when people call me up after they've been served with the notice of seizure, they sometimes ask, well, what should I do? And what I do is I advise them, under the current forfeiture administrative statute, if your property is under $7,500, you have the option to go to conciliation court. And then I tell them how they do that. I tell them the offices that are available in Dakota County for them to go and file their claim and summons. And from my experience, I can tell you that I have not received a call back from one of those people telling me that, you know, their case wasn't heard or was screwed up or, you know, there was some problem with that process. I know the clerks in our conciliation court are aware of the forfeiture process. They assist people in getting that form filled out and getting it to the proper county attorney or city attorney that's involved in that case. So that's one thing that I would like this committee to consider. In a couple of the bills, that option for conciliation court for administrative controlled substances is removed from the statute. I would also encourage you, as Mr. Glassrud stated, to maintain forfeiture as a civil proceeding, apart from any criminal proceedings. If forfeitures become a criminal proceeding, I fear there will be a tendency by our courts to track criminal cases of defendants along with the civil case of the claimant. If there isn't that separation, each case is not given its distinct ability to be decided on the merits and facts of that particular case. I anticipate that any statutory changes requiring forfeiture cases to be heard within a specific time frame is going to create problems for claimants who are also facing criminal charges. This was already brought up by the representative for the ACLU. A civil forfeiture case should not be heard prior to the disposition of a criminal case unless it's consented to by the defendant and his or her attorney. I know from my practice that prior to the conclusion of a criminal case, the defense attorney is not going to comply with discovery requests in a civil case, and they are not going to allow their client to testify in a forfeiture case that involves the same set of facts and circumstances that led to the criminal charges.
Ms. Horsch, can I ask you a question on that point?
Yep.
It's my understanding that under current law, designated offenses, gambling, RICO, most of the DWI, game and fish, wetlands, those already require a conviction. And so the expansion would just expand the requirement for conviction to the substance crimes. So I guess it's not that revolutionary. I mean, we're already requiring conviction in other areas of the law.
Madam Chair, yes, that is true. Under the designated offense and under the DWI statute, there is a requirement for a conviction. There is not that requirement right now in a controlled substance crime, controlled substance administrative forfeiture, or judicial forfeiture for controlled substance.
So are you encountering the problems that you're describing in administering the requirement for a conviction in the other areas of the laws that are currently in the books?
Madam Chair, there's not a problem with waiting for the conviction. The statute requires us to wait for that conviction. And for the administrative and controlled and judicial controlled substance forfeitures, what we're doing is we're waiting for the forfeiture action. We don't hear the forfeiture action before, if there are any criminal charges, we wait for those charges to be disposed of and finished, and then we proceed on the forfeiture action. We never push somebody to go to trial on a civil proceeding before the criminal action is concluded. And under a couple of the proposed bills, there is this requirement to hear a forfeiture action within so many days. And what I fear will happen is that a criminal case might not be concluded, and then we're going to be forced into a position of having to have a civil proceeding before the conclusion of that criminal case.
But in some of those provisions, there's also language providing for that time period to be extended, or we could certainly insert that to meet the need of the criminal proceedings if we need to put a pause on the civil forfeiture process. Would that be helpful?
Madam Chair, under Senator Latz's proposed bill, there is a provision that allows the claimant to waive that, what I call speedy trial, analogous to a speedy trial requirement. So that is helpful. Under SF 234, it requires that the hearing be within 180 days after the demand, and that does not allow for the claimant to waive that requirement.
Okay.
So I anticipate that may be a problem.
Okay. Sorry for the interruption. Please proceed.
Thank you. Similar statutory changes that provide for return of seized property if persons known to have a possessory interest are not served with a specific within a specific time frame provide an incentive for people to evade service. Current Minnesota law allows for a petition for return of property seized by law enforcement under Minnesota Statute 626.04. That statute contains a process for judicial review of seizure and retention of property. Lastly, there are some provisions in the pending bills that create statutory duties to be performed by county attorney's offices on behalf of claimants. This may create some sort of attorney-client relationship between the county attorney's office and the claimant. That would be a conflict of interest and creates ethical and legal issues for the county attorney's office. We have no authority to represent or take legal action on behalf of private citizens. It also may create some confusion for claimants as to what our role is as an advocate for the law enforcement while assisting them in the proceeding. Thank you.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
A question for you about the levels of the different assets that are being seized. I read in the auditor's report they track what the dollar amount is and the percentage of how many are up to $500, mm-hmm. how many are up to valued at $1,000. Can you just tell me how many would fit under that $7,500 cap in the conciliation court? Is it a majority of the assets seized?
Ms. Horsch?
Madam Chair, Senator, I would say it's a vast majority, at least from my experience in Dakota County, especially with controlled substance crimes.
Madam Chair, Orman. Just for the record, last year this committee heard my bill on conciliation court caps, and I actually passed out of this committee a $15,000 cap. It hasn't been changed in a very long time, and I'd like to think that if we change that cap of $15,000, now you're not just talking about the vast majority, but 99% would have a venue, a very speedy venue for the hearing on the return of their property.
Madam Chair, Senator, we'd certainly be willing to look at raising that conciliation court cap if only for the area of forfeitures. I think conciliation court, again, is a really good forum for people to come and talk to a judge about what they need to, you know, where that property came from and why it shouldn't be subject to forfeiture. If we get in some of the provisions in the bills required that we file a summons and complaint, and that necessarily kicks it into a district court action, and then, you know, first of all, we're having district court cases involving pretty insignificant dollar values. I think that may be a problem for our district courts, and it's intimidating for people to come into district court. They don't know the rules of civil procedure. It's intimidating for lawyers to go into district court sometimes. So I think if you can keep it in conciliation court, it's a good fit. That's at least my experience, and I know we keep track of, you know, how do we do in conciliation court, how do courts, and it's probably a 50-50 split, to tell you the truth. So I think the courts are taking a look at all the factors this committee has raised. They're looking at those factors, and they're making good decisions.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I just have to say, with all due respect, I was really shocked this summer when we first started hearing about this to really find out what the law was regarding forfeiture. I guess it wasn't an area I'd ever been exposed to before in practice. And the whole concept, as we're talking about this, you know, kind of so matter-of-factly here, is really surprising to most people when they find out that their property can be taken without any due process by law enforcement, and then the burden is on them to go try to get it back. And it might be working really well for law enforcement as a system in terms of fixing something you don't think is broken, but and it's probably fine if the person is guilty of something. But we're assuming that when we haven't proven that. And I think that kind of goes to the heart of this whole issue. If you're an innocent person, let's just put on that halo of innocence, which is what under the law we're supposed to assume about people until we've convicted them of something. So now we're assuming this is an innocent person and that person's property has been taken, and now we're going to tell them that it's up to them to figure out how to fill out forms and go to court and pay money and all of those steps in order to get their property back. So to me, that's just so it's hard to understand how we strayed that far in the law, regardless of what the courts have said or haven't said, away from basic fundamental constitutional principles. And so that was my initial reaction to that this last summer, and it's certainly still I still feel the same way about it. I don't think that county attorneys are doing something wrong. We've given you you're following the law that we've put in place, but it was really surprising to me to find out that this is the law and that this is what we're allowing to have happen. And then the other thing I was going to say more specifically to the comment about a conflict of interest, I think Senator Latz's bill does say that the money is still going to stay within the scope of public safety, but he's trying to take away that very specific conflict potential or appearance of conflict of interest situation between a particular person doing the confiscating and the fact that that might be helping to pay that particular person's salary. And it seems to me that the conflict you described regarding plea bargaining would actually be the opposite of the way you seem to see it, in my mind at least. If the money isn't going to stay with that particular specific department, then why is that person going to care about whether they bargain that away or not? I mean, I didn't follow your logic there. It seemed to me like there wasn't going to be an interest one way or the other in plea bargaining to specifically single out the forfeiture piece of it if it wasn't going to provide a direct financial benefit to that particular agency. So I just didn't quite follow the logic that you put forward for that. Maybe I misunderstood you.
Ms. Horsch, along the same line, I wonder if maybe you can just restate. I was trying to catch the point about there being a potential conflict of interest inherent in requiring for there to be a conviction. And I wonder if you could speak to that. Repeat your answer to that.
Madam Chair, maybe you can I think there's a conflict of, I don't know if this is addressing your question, and please interrupt me if it's not, but I think the conflict of interest we were talking about was if we're acting somehow on behalf of a claimant in the process. Is that what you're referring to, Madam Chair?
So I was trying hard to hear you before, and so maybe that's exactly the question I was asking you,
Okay. Because
you mentioned that by requiring for there to be a conviction, that somehow in the way that the dual process takes place, it's going to create a conflict of interest for the attorneys involved. And I just wanted you to repeat what you said about that, because I wasn't quite understanding it.
Madam Chair, I believe my comments were directed to a conflict of interest where there are certain provisions in the bills. For instance, in Senator Latz's bill, there's a requirement that if the person whose property has been seized fills out that notice or objection and gives it to the process server, and then the process server is supposed to give it to the county attorney's office, and then the county attorney's office is supposed to file that with the court, you know, that to me is creating a relationship between me and the claimant. I have an affirmative duty to do something on behalf of the claimant. And I don't represent the claimant. I don't have any legal relationship to the claimant. I think it may get confusing for the claimant on, you know, what my role is. And I want people to be clear that I represent the law enforcement agency, and I don't want them to rely in any respect on me.
So how does that differ, though, from what you mentioned about in terms of the current practice that you have in Dakota County, where people call you and say, I have property that has been seized and is going through forfeiture, and you walk them through the process of how they could get their property back? I would think filing a piece of paper away is less involved than the actual conversation and assistance, which implies much more of a relationship. So I don't, how does that differ?
Madam Chair, that's a good point of clarification that I should make. You know, before I talk to people on the phone, I certainly do advise them that I am not their lawyer. They have certainly the right to seek legal counsel, and I can advise them what the forfeiture statute says. And I feel as my role as in the prosecutor's office is to advise people of what their rights are. So I do that. I do tell people, this is under the current law, here is an option for you, and this is, you know, how you can do it without giving them, you know, legal representation. I think the difference between that and me having a legal duty to actually file something with the court, to take a piece of paper and file it, and what happens if I don't file that? I mean, am I liable to the claimant because I failed to file their demand for them? I don't know of any other area of the law where the opposing party files an answer on behalf of the other side.
I understand.
Thank you.
I think that there are ways that could be fixed through Senator Olson and Senator Ortman. The two O's are really...
we're working it today.
Yes, yeah. Working hard today.
Well, Madam Chair, and to me, again, that just sort of begs the question of whose burden it should be in the first place to have to establish the responsibility for the forfeiture. I mean, if you have to file a paper with the court in order to forfeit property, if it's your responsibility and your burden to establish this, then you're not doing it on behalf of anybody else. You're doing it on behalf of yourself to establish that right. So... So that was one point I wanted to make. But two other points I wanted to quickly make. I can see the issue about when there might be a question of you have some property here and it's obviously been taken a bunch of money in connection with a drug bust, and maybe there's some reason or other why you can't figure out who's responsible and what do you do about that. It seems to me, though, like there are some potential other avenues worth exploring. You know, isn't there something that just, I have some thing way back in the back of my mind about an action against property or something, you know, where you can actually have to establish something without, I just think there's some room to work that out so that we could get around that issue. And then the last thing I was going to say is, in terms of cost savings, it seems to me that when we're looking for ways to save costs within the court system, that somehow tying the forfeiture directly to the criminal action and putting those things together rather than requiring a whole separate action is a good way to reduce expenses within our court system.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I wanted to go back to something that maybe got missed in your first set of comments, which was this comment, Senator Olson, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought I heard you say that you were concerned that there was no due process before these assets were seized and that there was still a presumption of innocence. And I think that there is a presumption of innocence, but we actually authorize as a state arresting someone with probable cause, and they can be detained, sent to jail, pending a probable cause hearing or further consideration by the judge. So I think we have to put this in perspective and say, wait a minute, we actually arrest folks on probable cause, put them in jail. Yes, we're going to seize the assets on that same basis, and then later we can go back and decide whether there was a reason for that or not. And I'm hoping, Madam Chair, that either the county attorneys or the Sheriff's Association will address that, in particular, the standards by which the assets can be seized, so we can have a full hearing about what do you know? Is there a court order? Is there probable cause before you do this or not? And if you can clear that up for us, I think that would help.
So on that note, why don't we have you two can stay. We're going to have Mr. Franklin from the Sheriff's Association come up, and we'll take his testimony, and then whoever would like to, I would like you to answer Senator Ortman's question. So. Mr. Franklin, do you have other buddies you'd like to pull out to the table to be with you?
As much as I like my county attorneys here, I would invite my fellow colleagues from law enforcement. We have Dennis Flaherty with the MPPOA and Harlan Johnson from the Chiefs Association, if that's all right.
That's fine. That's fine.
I think it's probably easier for you to get a shot at all of us if we're grouped together. So,
A view. Please proceed.
Madam Chair, Jim Franklin with the Minnesota Sheriff's Association. I have several comments that I would like to make relative to items that were either not covered in the bill or that I'd like to expound on for just a moment. I would like to preface my comments by just simply saying much of what the county attorney has already discussed with you, I will not go back through and reiterate. I've been keeping a tally, and I have more check marks on the county attorney side that we agree with than the ACLU side. So just to kind of let you know where we're coming from on our point of view. With regards to the senator's question on probable cause, I want to make it very clear that if we do what Senator Olson has articulated in any law enforcement agency and take that property, it's called theft. You have no right to take it. You have no probable cause to take it. Therefore, it's theft, and an allegation should be made, and it should be investigated. And that is what has been done in the gang strike force. We have allegations. They're being investigated. Unfortunately, it is not completed. I know it's been tried in the media, and the case is over. But nonetheless, there's still allegations. But we would classify, under Senator Olson's case, that would be classified as a theft. Why did you take something when you have no probable cause, no reason to take that from that individual? When you take something from the individual, it's associated with the probable cause to, number one, stop the individual. Number two, articulate why you have that individual stopped in custody and why you're focusing on whatever that is. And then the law normally will give you the right, if you proceed forward with an arrest, assuming there is one, to seize an item that might be related. But there has to be those connections and pieces. To simply take something is unlawful.
Just for the record, the scenario you're responding to was asked by Senator Ortman and not Senator Olson. So, please.
And if I could just really quickly, just to make sure we're on the same page, I didn't say without probable cause. I said without due process, and I'd be happy to explain why I think there's a big difference between how we handle due process as we go forward for someone when we're arresting them versus what happens when we seize their property. And that's the kind of the crux of the distinction from my standpoint. But
well, let's let the witness speak, okay, and then we can have a discussion. Sorry, Mr. Franken.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let me go back and just talk a little bit about, because one of the questions you had asked, Madam Chair, was to address the issue of a receipt when a forfeiture it comes about. There's really kind of two scenarios. The first has to do with an arrest scenario. The second has to do with a search warrant scenario. If it's a search warrant scenario as to why you are there, then you have to, by law, leave a receipt for something you take. That's a receipt. That's part of that search warrant. If it's an arrest that you are making, we are again back to the probable cause issue of why you're there, why you're making that arrest. And then you give notice to the person that you're seizing that item and you intend to have that item forfeited. At that point, that accompanies whatever that arrest or that citation or whatever it is that that person is in your custody for. That paperwork then goes back to the office, and a receipt, an inventory, is done at the office where those items are attached to the case file that becomes a public document or a working document that's covered under data practices for a law enforcement file, of which ultimately at a point in time becomes available to the subject of the data or the arrestee. As was alluded to previously in the gang strike force issues, it is apparent or at least alleged that none of those procedures or protocols were followed. But you ask about what is the normal procedure. That is the normal procedure. It's important to recognize there's 36 members on the gang strike force. 12 or 14 are the focus of a criminal investigation, which means one-third were doing it wrong, two-thirds were attempting to do it right. I often say in my 42 years of law enforcement, just about the time you think you've seen it all, something new comes up. And I can just simply say that the comments made by the strike commander in reply to some of the testimony were, from my opinion, egregious as a veteran of law enforcement that has diligently tried to uphold the Constitution. And in many cases, I felt I've had far more things in common with the ACLU and my upholding of the Constitution. We serve the people. And I do take a little bit of offense to Senator Latt's comments with regards to the implication of law enforcement being tainted. Do we have some members that perhaps have tainted? That is alleged, will be decided. But for those of us who have diligently worked hard, we serve the people. We are an instrument of the people. And we want to assure that the people are adequately represented, their rights are protected, just like any of us, and we are a part of them. And I take that very, very seriously, and we teach that in our sheriff's organization day and night to drive that point home. The other thing that I want to comment on was sort of an anecdotal story about the DWI and the car. I can tell you we have given more cars back to people than we have kept. We have to live with the citizens we serve. They are our neighbors, our friends, our church members, and we understand. And those cars are repeatedly returned, especially in hardship cases. We see that. There are cases such as one last week in which a family member came, of which my wife is in law enforcement, and directly said, "Thank you for taking and impounding the car. We couldn't do it because he was driving around with the grandchildren and now he can't get his car back." So there is anecdotal stories of, does it give us pleasure? No, it's a junker. But do we get satisfaction that something good came out of it to help that family? Yes. And those are the kinds of things that we do work to try to achieve whenever we can. As long as we're on the issue of the car, The testimony has already been given by Peggy with regards to the filing in conciliation court. That is a very important thing for us, and it's my understanding it's only $45, and it's also my understanding all cars can go through that same process. So if you have a expensive vehicle, you can still go through the conciliation court process, not through the $325 filing fee process. Additionally, my concern is if we move everything to the criminal realm and all of these cases to go to court, we already have an overburdened court that can't handle what we have now. If we push more there, it's another fiscal note on the state budget sheet that has implications for all of us taxpayers. And I think that's one of the concerns that we want to take a note. My final comment on the car situation. In order to take a car that is in joint title, you must show that the husband and the wife are joint tenants at the home, and it must be a first-degree DWI case. It can't be that first-time fourth DWI case. So, again, we have differing kinds of things there that we have to deal with before we just, quote, seize or take that car. There are other things that must be done to achieve those goals. My final comment, Madam Chair, is that good policies and good practices should be emulated and used by all. And I think there's a number of ideas and suggestions in these bills right here, and without going through, I would just simply say that we as law enforcement will sit down and work to achieve something. We think it's better to have it in model policies and training and teaching than it is to have it captured in statutory law, simply from the standpoint of it's much more difficult to change versus a policy change. If a court decision or something comes out, we can change that much easier or much better. But we would just simply say that we are willing to work on these things. We are on the same page of wanting to serve the people with the best policy and procedures that we can, and where we have violations of due process and other things, we will vigorously investigate and prosecute those. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, if I might ask Mr. Franklin a question about, you said something about if they're in joint title on the house.
On the car. I'm sorry.
I thought you said house.
Did I say house?
Mr. Franklin.
Car.
And I was trying to figure out the connection. Okay. Okay,
sorry,
thank
about
you.
That.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for taking the time to be here. And I think, at least from my perspective, I think it's important for me to clarify, because I certainly wouldn't want any of you to misunderstand any of the comments I've made as being any of these proposals coming forward as, or any of us who support them as being geared against or toward law enforcement. From my perspective, Senator Moi said, this is really, you know, what happened with the Metro Bank Strike Force just happened to bring this area of law to our attention and focus. And some of us looking at this, as I said before, we're kind of surprised at how the law works right now. And so, to me, this is about what the right thing is to do for under constitutional principles, what's the right thing to do in terms of handling this from a legal perspective. It's certainly not in any way directed against or toward law enforcement. So I just want to make that clear. From the standpoint of where I was coming from, I didn't say the property's taken without probable cause. I said due process. And the reason I look at it that way is because when you're taking someone's liberty away from them, the probable cause finding step is just the initial step in the process. And then every step along the way, we have built into our law things that have to happen where the burden stays with law enforcement and then with the county attorney's office to prove certain things. And then we can ultimately never take away, make any permanent decision with regard to that person's liberty until we've had some kind of finding of guilt. And so
that's the kind of thing that I was talking about when I say we've kind of flipped this on its head when it comes to property. And once you have probable cause established, it's kind of like game over, unless the person themselves goes through the time and expense and has the burden of proof of doing something to get their property back. And so it was not directed as that law enforcement is doing anything wrong through this process, just that simply as legislators who are also serving the people, looking at this issue, to me it's a very important fundamental fairness and constitutional issue, and it shouldn't be interpreted as any kind of negative connotation toward law enforcement.
Mr. Harland or Mr. Flaherty, either of you would like to comment? Ms. Harland?
Yep. Madam Chair, my name is Harlan
Mr.
Johnson.
Mr. Johnson, I'm sorry.
I'm the executive director for the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association, and I'm here to say the Chiefs Association supports, and if I could speak as eloquently as our colleagues in the County Attorney Association did, I would repeat exactly what they had to say. So what I'm saying is that I think they've stated our position very well.
But you probably wouldn't want to answer the questions that is being directed at them, right?
That's why they'd be here to support.
Mr. Flaherty.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Dennis Flaherty, and I serve as Executive Director of the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association. And interestingly enough, I knew back in, in July when the legislative auditor released his investigation, the results of his investigation on the strike force. I just knew that when the session started, I'd be in room 15 talking about the oversight of police task forces and probably forfeiture. So I'm not surprised that we're here. I will say that, you know, that name keeps popping up, the gang strike force, this afternoon. And I would just like to point out, as I've talked to some of you previously, is that I think, first of all, the forfeiture law has worked exactly the way it was intended to work. And I remember when it came into law, and interestingly enough, the same people that are urging sweeping changes are the same people that, or at least the same groups that, that worked hard to prevent it from being passed. But nevertheless, fortunately it did, and it has been, without a doubt, the most effective tool that law enforcement has to go after drug traffickers and organized criminal gang activity. That has proven to be true. It is extremely effective. And while I'm not opposed at all to any changes to make it better, we would strongly urge you not to pass, for instance, the LATS proposal, because anything that would eliminate administrative forfeiture, cap administrative forfeiture, take the proceeds from the forfeiture and give it to the state, it would really harm the effectiveness of law enforcement. I think Senator Ortman made a great point when she talked, or she asked, do you think law enforcement is getting rich on this? And, you know, that if there is this perception that that's not the case, that's the case, that truly is not. We have, I think, 22 different task forces throughout the state. And if they did not have the proceeds, they would be pretty much put out of business, particularly in the financial environment cities and counties are faced with. They just wouldn't be able to have the staff to put out on loan to work these task forces. And I think you had a chance to listen to some of them throughout your hearings, and I'm sure you'd agree they are hardworking, they're productive, and they're doing a great service to the citizens of Minnesota. And so I think that's really my point. And other than that, we have, I think, maybe a dozen officers that are alleged to have violated and abused their authority, violated the law.
We have, I think, today 10,000 cops that work throughout our state at every level of government. And so I would hope we could put that into some type of perspective as we proceed in the coming weeks. I would welcome the opportunity, Senator, to work with you, Madam Chair, and any member of this committee to make the law better. I think your bill, Senator Mua, and Representative Mullery's bill, I think is in the right direction. I think it provides some reforms, if you will, or some positive changes, and we could certainly, I'd like to talk to you about that. But clearly, and I care the most about law enforcement being effective and serving the citizens of Minnesota, and I know all of you care about that. And so while we can talk about some changes, let's not throw out what I believe, and I've talked to hundreds since the summer of my members from all regions of the state, and I know they would join me in saying that it has been tremendously effective, and please do not take that tool away from them. Thank you very much.
Well, gentlemen, I don't see that there's anything in here that is proposing to take that tool away from law enforcement.
Well, Madam Chair, since I just said that, I think the LATS bill does. I think that it eliminates administrative forfeiture. It requires convictions and on felony level offenses before proceeds can be seized. I do see it that way from my perspective. That would be extremely counterproductive and not helpful at all to your law enforcement community.
Mr. Franklin?
Madam Chair, just on a similar note, from a sheriff's perspective and from the county attorney's perspective, both of which are public elected officials, the way some of the bills are crafted takes away the autonomy, the authority to make some decisions with regards to some of the forfeiture funds and transfers those funds to local units of government. And under the control of five county commissioners, each of which is elected not by the entire county, but by one-fifth of the district of the county, which we then get into the issues of which district gets which proceeds of the funds, and we law enforcement are caught in the whipsaw of the politics of the county board or the city council arguing over the redeployment of those dollars. As we have had in the past, those funds are put into a law enforcement account, but they require the same scrutiny of expenditure, including all of the audit procedures, all of the procedures to purchase, all of the kinds of things. A county check or a city check is issued. It's not the sheriff's check. So we pretty much follow that right now, but I do see that if that funding is shifted into the governing body, that this is going to become a political type of situation at another level. Again, I think detracting from the overall whole of law enforcement, and that's something that we think is detrimental to law enforcement and to the service that we give to the citizens.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, I'm not even quite sure I understood what you said, but I thought what you said was that in a bill that would propose for the county board to have decision-making authority, that they would somehow try to parse it out based on something. I mean, I don't even understand how that could that logic would be. They get money all the time from property taxes and other funds, then they vote as a board to decide how to spend it in a general county way. And
Mr. Franklin, is it an issue that the proposed language is not clear, that the county board has jurisdiction over the county sheriff's pot of money and the local police departments, that the trustee would be sort of the local, either the township or the elected city council of that local? Is it that the language is not clear to specify that? So there's some multi-jurisdictional conflicts there? Mr. Franklin?
Madam Chair, there could be, depending on how you interpret the language, and again, going back how it's written, there could be conflicts between the jurisdictions themselves, the multi-jurisdictions, as to whose authority, and then according to at least one of the bills, it would require that the county board would be the approving authority to expend the funds. And while all county boards maybe in the Northwest get along very well, I can just say that there's one or two in the state that bicker over which bridge or which park or which where gets done first. Again, the sheriff and the county attorneys are public elected officials by all of the county and have to serve all of them without getting into that nitty-gritty of debate and discussion. And up to this point, as Mr. Flaherty has said, we think it's worked rather well, and we have no abuses that we are aware of anywhere. And we think it's part because we're following a shared relationship with law enforcement trained to make a good policy decision for things that should be done on a basis of their community or the county, and then informing the county board of what we're doing and the scope and the parameters, which builds a partnership and says, yeah, that really makes a lot of sense. So I think it's more of a collaboration. However, I think the way at least part of the bills were written, and depending on where they go and what language is used, it would tip the scale too much to another way that might be detrimental.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ortman.
To that point, I mentioned this before, but there are federal guidelines that restrict the forfeited funds to be used to supplant operating budgets, and that's what county boards do. They pass operating budgets, and so you wouldn't want to mix up those two things. The sheriff and the county attorney don't create their own operating budgets, right? They come from the county board, which approves them. And so the reason the guidelines do that is to make sure there is no supplanting, that if the forfeited funds are available to law enforcement, they're at the discretion of law enforcement for the purpose of crime fighting. And then the federal guidelines, and maybe you can opine on this, Mr. Franklin, but they are very restrictive as to what the purposes, proper purposes are for using the forfeiture funds. It's not just anything. There are specific limits to what can be used, they can be used for, and maybe you want to talk about that, Mr. Franklin. I think maybe it would help. Mr. Franklin?
Madam Chair, I'll try to be very brief. Yes, that's very correct. It's used for, in many, many cases, training and equipment and other kinds of things that would normally not be in an operational budget but would be necessary to carry out some sort of duties relative to an investigation. So just to be very brief and concise, that line might get blurred, and like I say, up to this point, it has not been an issue. It has not been a problem. And so I would just caution going down that particular road.
Mr. Franklin, I've heard you say that, I mean, at least three or four times in the last 15 minutes. And I guess the question I have for you or all three of you, and maybe it's just a rhetorical question for all of us to think about, is that, you know, in the very thoughtful conversations we've been having all summer involving all of you, as well as other stakeholders in this conversation, there's a continual insistence that the law works and it works fine and that it doesn't need to be messed with. And yet it was really difficult to get information from the frontline practitioners about whether or not there's a uniformity in the way that the law is being practiced and being implemented and being carried out throughout the state. It was very hard to get that information from the testifiers at the table. And so I think that, you know, you mentioned the fact that you give back a lot of vehicles in hardship situations. But there really is nothing in the law that says you have to do that. And yet you do that. And I think one of the goals in having this conversation is, one, upfront recognize that it is not about being punitive, but it is about doing our job as policymakers to look at what's in the books and to try to match that up with what's being practiced and implemented out in the field, and where there may be inconsistencies, not to the disadvantage or not that it would adversely affect the public, but that I think there is a good public policy desire to want to create some uniformity in how we apply the law, so that we, to the degree that we can exercise our oversight to limit the discretions that may be out there. And so I think that the intent here is not to in any way be retaliatory, but I do think that we have a duty as policymakers, when an opportunity presents itself, to examine what our statutes look like, where they're at, and try to match it to what is being practiced out in the field. And so I don't know that it's working perfectly. I take your word for that. But I hope that as we move forward, there's at least an ounce of doubt and concern in your mind that there may be occasions where it's not working out, and that when we have an opportunity, we ought to have that very candid conversation. And so I, you know, the message I hope you leave here with is that based on the proposals that are before you, I don't think it's intended to be hostile to the practitioners in the front line and what they do. But I think that it's an obligation, an opportunity for us to do this. Statutes and laws periodically go through recodifications. Statutes and laws periodically go through reviews. And I think that as lawmakers, that's our job, is when an opportunity comes along to do that. When ideas are good, then we take it up on it. When we do the examination and we see that, you know what, things are all right, then we move on and we leave it alone. But at least we should give ourselves the opportunity to have the conversation. And so, you know, I thank you for your input. And as we move forward in this conversation, we certainly want to have your participation, your involvement, because, again, it is about getting a constructive outcome. It is not about moving in the direction that doesn't work for all of us. So thank you very much. We have one more witness. If he is still here, if he wishes to testify, I would like to give him the next 5 minutes to give us some his thoughts, if you would like to do that. Mr. Tom Plunkett, is he still here? Mr. Plunkett, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Tom Plunkett. I'm a lawyer in private practice in St. Paul, and I'm also here on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, and thank you for this opportunity. So many good comments have already been made, and so much thoughtful discussion has occurred before we came here today that I just want to cut through to some practical considerations and concerns that I have, instead of reviewing what we've already talked about. But one thing I wanted to respond to is that we had a very interesting piece of information from Dakota County that anecdotally people who call Dakota County regarding conciliation court, that those individuals do get assistance. And I've practiced in Dakota County extensively. You'll find it to be one of the most well-run counties that you could possibly hope for. They do a great job. However, their phone number is not on the form. Notice of forfeiture form. So those are people who figured out how to do this. I have a notice of forfeiture form that I could provide to the committee. It's for $600 of U.S. currency. And it's an actual form from a case that I handled where I won the forfeiture. However, I didn't file a forfeiture on the currency because I filed a forfeiture on the property, which was worth much more than $600. I told this person, well, I'm going to charge you $322 to file your $600 forfeiture. That's a fee, plus I'm going to charge you attorney's fees. It's well in excess of $600. Why don't you go file in conciliation court? Well, that person obviously didn't do it, because once I won the property forfeiture, I called up the county attorney's office, and to the same person I spoke to, I says, hey, you know, we just won. You're giving me back all that property. How about giving back that $600? and we were just told very simply, well, he should have filed a claim on that, and you can't have it back. We get anecdotal information that in some places they're giving back motor vehicles, and I believe it. I think it's true. But, you know, that's not across the board, and that's what we're hoping that the forfeiture statute can do is make things fair across the board. The conflict of interest of having a notice filed, if you consider how conciliation court actually works, the conciliation courts do serve notices on the parties once you file your claim. So I don't know how having a court system where the actual document is simply returned and brought back in creates a conflict of interest. Another thing that I wanted to address was that the comment was made that the only time that there's forfeitures is in the case of first-degree DWIs, and that simply isn't true. I think it was an honest mistake, but when we look at forfeitures in terms of that specific kind of a case, you can have a forfeiture on a first-time DWI if the right circumstances present themselves, and that would be a couple of aggravating factors. You could have a forfeiture for sure on a second offense if there was one additional aggravating factor. So forfeitures are not reserved for the highest and most heinous offenders. I didn't bring statistical information with me, but I do have it in my office regarding the impact of preventing crimes in the future. And my statistical information taken from federal studies would say that simply punishing people doesn't actually have a deterrent effect. But the presence of a criminal justice system does have a deterrent effect. Those were the practical considerations that I wanted to address. And also, a lot has been talked about. We've been mixing forfeiture and seizure back and forth. We've been saying that if we push any of these forfeiture changes through, that we're going to eviscerate the opportunity of law enforcement to seize property. And 626.04 is the statute that pertains to seizure, completely unaffected by any of the bills, as far as I can see. And then forfeiture is something that is done with property if you want to forfeit the property, which is keeping it certainly different than seizure. And it's a subtle but important difference. I do have a flow chart that goes over seizure and forfeiture if anybody wanted that. I want to thank the committee for giving me an opportunity to address the committee. If there was any specific questions, I'd be happy to respond.
Questions, members? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate especially the comment you made about the difference between forfeiture and seizure, because in my mind, and I wouldn't even say that I necessarily agree with some of the direction of what the ACLU and you have talked about with forfeiture, because to me it's not necessarily just a punishment thing. In some cases, it's getting that instrument of a crime out of the system that can be beneficial to society. So I'm not arguing with the benefits of forfeiture, and I'm not trying to undermine the concept of forfeiture. I'm just concerned about the concept of due process as it goes through the establishing whether seized property should ultimately be forfeited without those normal kinds of due process steps, and that's my concern.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I would tend to agree with you, and I think that the bills that we're promoting would all say that contraband and other things, other instrumentalities of or criminal things, are automatically seized and kept. So those are taken out of the commerce act. Thank you.
All right, there being no further questions, thank you, Mr. Plunkett. Members, any thoughts or reactions to the testifiers and the language that is before us? There being none, we are adjourned.
Okay.